Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th. It's the 11th of January already. It just goes by, doesn't it? This hour of the program, Astronomy Magazine put together top 10 stories of 2009. New evidence of dark energy, Hubble restored, NASA finds moon water, a huge year for extrasolar worlds, supernova as cosmic ray sources, the world celebrates astronomy, and baby stars are spotted near the galactic center, and the list goes on. We're going to be talking about the big stories in astronomy, which was the year, the 400th anniversary of astronomy, and it was celebrated by people all over the world. Last year was, so this is the 401st anniversary. We may as well celebrate that in just as big a way, don't you think? Our guest this hour is Liz Cruzy, Associate Editor of Astronomy Magazine. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Liz and emails. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Liz. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. So was this one of those years when you had maybe 500 things on the list and you had to get it down to 10?
Yeah, it was a pretty big year, and things just kept occurring close to the end of the year, too, as I'm sure you saw on our list of the 11 through 15, which is online for subscribers only. But yeah, it was a really big year. We were working on the exoplanet story, which was number one, and we had to update it every few weeks because we just kept, just new things kept being found. The planet, the most rocky planet, the smallest exosolar planet, a huge haul of 32 planets in just one study. It just kept changing.
So because of the sophistication of the instruments as years go by, do you imagine that you'll get even bigger and more important stories as this year goes on and this decade goes on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we launched how many new satellites last year with Herschel, which is studying infrared, the Planck telescope, which is studying the cosmic microwave background more precisely than the WMAP survey, which was a huge story a number of years, Kepler, which is looking for extrasolar planets, and it's also studying the stars that those planets are around, and that's starting to return data, as I'm sure you've heard from the last week. We're going to be launching in a few more years the James Webb Space Telescope, which is another infrared telescope, the Mars Space or the Mars Science Laboratory, which will be launched next year to actually study the Martian surface. So it'll, as the missions keep going on and we keep sending more up into space and having, Large Hadron Collider here on Earth, which could potentially unify forces in physics, depending on what it finds. It's as the tools get more sophisticated, as you say, it'll definitely have a lot more stories, and it'll be a lot harder to narrow them down to the top 10.
I always think that we don't know enough about these stories. We talk about astronomy, every now and then, but it seems when there's a very large discovery, it makes the news in a very short, maybe sentence, or it makes the newspaper for just a very short blurb. But you think about all the years that have gone into that particular discovery and how significant it is, and it just doesn't go very far. And I'm wondering, why is that?
I think it's maybe attention span and everything else that's going on in the world. Mm. But each of these missions, you're launching something into space. It takes 20 years to plan it, get the funding, build it. And, for who knows how long it'll be up in space. Something like Cassini is up there for, in total, so far, it's been 6 years. And it has a few more years to go, which is great. But, when the Huygens probe ended up deploying and landing on Titan's surface, that was in the news a lot, and then it kind of went out of the news. But it found lots of stuff, and scientists still use all that data for further studies. So the data itself, while it may not be in the news for huge amounts of time, is definitely used in the future for many, many years to come.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Hubble for a moment. I know that was your number two story, and it had been, I didn't realize this, 7 years since there were any repairs done on Hubble. We've had some extraordinary pictures come from that telescope. Can you talk about how important it has been to us and what kinds of repairs were done and how much longer it's going to carry on?
The big things that were fixed on Hubble, well, aside from having the main camera updated, there had been some minor repairs in the last 7 years, but nothing as major as this. They also replaced the gyroscopes, which were, I remember hearing about the gyroscopes failing a number of years ago, and if one more had gone, Hubble would have pretty much just spun out of control. Oh. And wouldn't be able to point at an image or at an object to take an image, and its life would have been gone. And it was just all you needed was one gyroscope to go, and it would be over, which is very scary for such a fabulous mission. But they replaced all six of the gyroscopes, so they're all up and running, and they replaced the main data handling unit, which is providing all the electronics. They replaced, as I said, the main camera, so higher resolution, and also a spectrograph, which looks at the spectra, which is pretty much the wavelengths or the colors of an object. The new camera as well, the Wide Field Camera 3, can reach into the near-infrared and up to the ultraviolet, in addition to the visible light spectrum. So it has a wider range than the Wide Field Camera 2, which was the previous version. And that new camera, you've, I'm sure, in the last week seen what came out of that with the Hubble Ultra Deep Field image, which has now peered back and seen galaxies more distant than any other image has seen galaxies. Mm. So it's so far, it's given us some great science, some great data, and I think they expect it to go until about 2014, which is when the James Webb Space Telescope should launch. So I know originally the mission was supposed to go until about 2010, 2009, and luckily they repaired it, and now it's going to go until, and maybe it'll continue going, but it should make it at least until when the James Webb Space Telescope.
Oh, that's great. I know that you've published some extraordinary photos that have come from Hubble. Is there a place you can go on the web where you can see what that telescope has given us over the years?
Oh, yeah. The website, www.hubblesite.org, has a gallery. It also has news. You can click on the News Center and see all the press releases that they've done since it's been up. And you can look at just gallery of images in there. You can search a particular object, or you can look up nebulae versus galaxies, any category of object. But, yeah, it's a great resource if you just want to look at all the gorgeous images.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are gorgeous. You'd like to just publish all of them and put them all around your room, wouldn't you? Maybe you have. One of the stories that made a whole lot of news was water on the moon, a crucial resource on the moon. That was number three in your list of top 10.
Mm-hmm. There were quite a few missions last year which found evidence for water. India's, I'm going to probably not say this properly, but Chandrayaan, it was India's first mission to the moon, and that found evidence of water on the surface by looking at the spectra. And LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, also found very similar evidence of water on the moon and in these regions that are permanently shadowed, so the water would actually be frozen ice because it's so cold. But a number of missions before LCROSS slammed into the moon October 9th, a number of those missions found evidence of water on the surface. And then LCROSS, when it impacted the moon, dug up under the surface water. And I guess the value of that, it was probably, 24 gallons of water that they estimated that they found. So it was a pretty big find.
Mm-hmm. So it's important, if you were going to use, tell me if I'm right here, if you were going to use the moon as some kind of station for exploration of other planets in the future, you could drink the water from the moon?
I think you'd probably have to filter it, but the idea is that you have a starting point. You know, you have ice that you can then melt down and filter, and you can drill into the surface and find ice. So that's a starting point instead of having to bring over gallons and gallons of water, which is heavy and would take more fuel to get there. So having it at a location on the moon as a starting point is much easier for future missions.
And when you talk about this L-Cross smashing into the moon, what was the story on that? Was it disappointing and we didn't get all the information we should have because of the landing? Did they expect it to land that way? It was kind of a big deal when it happened.
Yeah, I think what happened is it wasn't nearly as bright as observers expected. I know they changed target location pretty close to when it was supposed to land or smash into the moon, and it wasn't as directly visible. It was almost hidden by a ridge from certain viewpoints. So I know, according to the public opinion, it was disappointing, but as the scientists said, once they analyzed that data, it gave them everything that they had hoped for. So the data itself was great. It just wasn't quite as spectacular of a impact as many observers had hoped for.
Mm-hmm. We're welcoming phone calls for you. Our guest is Associate Editor of Astronomy Magazine, Liz Cruzy, and their issue has the top 10 astronomy stories of 2009, which was a big year in astronomy. We celebrate the 400th anniversary of astronomy. Doesn't get a lot bigger than that until you get to the 500th, of course. We're going to welcome phone calls for her. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email address talk@wpr.org. Ray from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Ray.
Good morning. I have two items. The first one is the starting and stopping of a beam of light. And this beam of light was projected into a gas cloud of atoms called the Bose-Einstein condensate. And the beam of light was like frozen within this. I don't truly understand the principle, but it was stopped within the cloud. The cloud was moved, and the same beam of light was restarted without any extra energy input, which is the first time this has ever been done. And it's very strange in a way if you think about what that means.
When did this happen?
This year, I'm pretty sure I read it in Scientific American, or maybe I had seen it online or something, but it's just a very strange phenomenon with light.
I had heard about something similar maybe a few years ago, too. And to be honest, I don't know many details about it, except Bose-Einstein condensates are extraordinarily cold, just above absolute zero, and so they'd be able to almost stop vibrational energy or just cool it down so that it slows. But other than that, I'm not sure about the details. Mm. I'm sorry about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the second item was solar flares, and I guess the last 2 years have been extremely quiet. The sun has been extremely quiet, and it turns out there was another period just back not that long ago, 1645 until the early 1700s, where there was a lack of solar flares and there was a mini ice age. And we have experienced cooling the last 2 years, I know, here in Wisconsin, to be that way. And I'm pretty sure the entire planet has actually had a slight cooling the last 2 years. And maybe you could explore the effect of the sun and solar flares on our temperature.
They did announce something in the last year about a reasoning behind the lack of solar activity or the much smaller amounts of solar activity. That was on our possible list of the top 10. I cannot for the life of me remember what the details on that were either. I'm sorry. But yeah, that was announced probably the summertime. And I don't remember directly any relationship between it being colder, but I'd agree with you that it's been a very cold winter all around. But I know that was released back in the summertime, so Sorry, I'm not being very helpful.
No, that's okay. Thanks very much for your call, Ray. Let's go. Well, we'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. The number one story of the year, let's spend a little bit more time on extrasolar worlds and what indeed we did see, how we saw it, and whether or not the instrument that allowed us to see extrasolar worlds is continuing.
Yeah, so far there are lots of different instruments that are contributing to this study. Kepler is a big one, and it launched back in March. And we didn't include that specifically because there's going to be so much data coming out of that project in the next few years. And as you probably heard from the last week, at the American Astronomical Society conference, the Kepler team announced that they had found five extrasolar planets. All five are basically hot Jupiters between the sizes of Neptune and Jupiter, and they're very close to their stars, much closer than Mercury is to the Moon. So they're not habitable, and they're not Earth-like, but Kepler definitely has the accuracy to be able to detect such a planet, you know, an Earth-sized planet in roughly the same distance away from Earth as from our star. And it would take a few years to discover that because Kepler needs to find, it looks for slight dimming of the star by the planet. So from our viewpoint, as the planet blocks the star, the light output would dim slightly. And if Kepler sees that four times in a pattern, periodic four times, then it can figure out the size of that planet that's blocking it. And that would be a good way to figure out if it's an Earth-sized planet in roughly an Earth distant orbit. So that, if we're going to find anything like that, it'll be about 3 years or so before that's announced.
I
but
see.
It has the ability to do so. Other missions, you know, one thing here was just being able to directly image extrasolar planets. And while they're massive planets that they're imaging, this story actually came out in November of 2008, but it had missed press time for our previous year top 10, so we included it in this year. But the fact that Hubble and Gemini and Keck, all those telescopes were able to directly observe planets circling other stars is just a huge step in the resolution of these telescopes. So the hope is that we'll be able to do that for additional planets and eventually for Earth-sized planets.
Hmm. And how long will they be able to keep going?
All these different telescopes?
Right.
A lot of it depends on funding. You know, it's been a rough year for all funding.
For everything, yes.
But so far, they're all funded for a number of years. I mean, Hubble, we're expecting it to go until around 2014. Kepler should be up there for a number more years. And both Keck and Gemini are ground-based telescopes. And so funding, it costs less to operate them because they're not in space. But those should be, you know, and they're run by observatory or universities, so that helps too. They're education based.
Right. Let's welcome more phone calls for you. Liz Cruzy is our guest, associate editor of Astronomy Magazine. We are talking about the top 10 stories from the skies in the year 2009, the 400th anniversary of astronomy. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Here's our number, by the way, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that. It's talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls. Jerry Ann from South Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jerry Ann.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Great, thank you. This is a fascinating subject for me. I was city editor of the Pasadena Star News in Pasadena, California, and included in our coverage area was Jet Propulsion Laboratories, which was, of course, very much involved in the Hubble telescope. And when it was launched in 1990, amid great fanfare and this is going to do wonderful things, it was followed almost immediately with the devastating news that the lens was out of focus. And a great deal of criticism, all the wasted money and laughing stock and so forth. And then miraculously, it was somehow fitted with glasses so it was to correct its myopia. and it has really become the little fantastic little engine that could story with all of those fantastic achievements that have followed. And even though we did stories on this, I still am just fascinated by how repairs can be affected on these craft that are out there like that. The Hubble telescope, to me, was the most amazing story. And I don't know if your guest has the expertise to go into or to explain in rather simple layman's terms how something like that could have been done. How was the Hubble fitted with glasses?
It's another question I probably won't be able to answer. I know that all these missions to upgrade and fix the Hubble Space Telescope have taken quite a bit of detailed effort from the astronauts. I know the most recent one, I think they had to replace or unscrew like 50 screws to replace one of the cameras. And you're doing this in space where obviously you're in a big clunky suit, so you don't quite have the same movement as you do on Earth. Aside from that, though, I'm not quite sure on the – I guess I don't really have the expertise to explain how they could have done something like that. But that's a great question for us to include in the magazine in the future.
I'm wondering if a lot of it is done through computer manipulation from – crews, staff on Earth, or if, as you say, people actually go to the Hubble telescope itself and do hands-on repairs.
Do you know that? Did they do hands-on repairs?
In the most recent mission, they did. They used an arm on the International Space Station and pulled in the Hubble Space Telescope into the cargo bay. And they did, I think it was 5 spacewalks where 2 different astronauts actually repaired these things, took them off, and you know, had to make sure to catch the screws and replace all of this information or all of these instruments. So it was a pretty long process. I think, I don't remember, but one of the spacewalks took many hours. I mean, they were out there individually working on these instruments for hours.
I remember reading about that. In 1990, however, we didn't have all of the technology and the International Space Station and so forth available to do that. And it just seemed like such a sci-fi kind of thing.
Yes, right. It still seems like a sci-fi thing to
oh,
me.
Yeah.
Jerry Ann, let me ask you, because you were a reporter in this area, why is it that these stories and the enormity of these projects and how they may or may not, the controversy concerning how they may benefit humankind, don't seem to have staying power? They're star stories when they appear, and then they're not with us anymore, so we don't have full information. You're fascinated by them. I am. I think most people are, but we don't know very much.
Right, and my sense is that we as a society are having a shorter and shorter attention span, and there's
true.
Always the new story that pops up that crowds out the old story, and the old story becomes kind of just that. It's the old story. What is new, or what, especially something that's flashy that will
right.
catch people's attention that's happening. With the Hubble, of course, the launch of the Hubble was a huge story. We were a relatively small newspaper, about 50,000 circulation in Pasadena. We had a fantastic reporter who covered the science area, Jet Propulsion Laboratories and Caltech and so forth. And I think a lot of it depends on the expertise of reporting staff and their interest and commitment and passion. And then an awful lot of it just boils down to plain old dollars and cents. What is going to catch the people's, the paying public's, the circulation, it boosts circulation and readers' attention and so forth. What do they want to read about? And Kathleen, I'm sure you are very well aware of how celebrity-driven our news has become.
Yes.
And, so I think that those are some of the factors.
Yeah, thank you so much for your call.
Well,
really
thank you.
Nice to hear from
you. I appreciate the information, too. It's a very interesting program.
Thank you. And when you put together stories like this and your cover stories, are you attuned to Liz, or would you find that because you're a specialty kind of magazine, people who love astronomy are going to come to you? Or do you have to create certain kinds of stories that you know will excite a massive number of people?
Well, when we're putting together the top 10, I mean, there are so many stories, as you mentioned. It was a really big year. And we put together a list of, you know, maybe 20 stories that we feel we found important, not just from the last year, but what will carry through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Hubble Space Telescope will continue to have additional findings. So that factored in. But then we also think about what our readers and what the general public would be most interested in to see again, or what they felt were very important stories. And so we try to factor all that in when narrowing it down.
Right. We had somebody who couldn't stay online who wanted to know, and I'm not even sure what this is, so explain it to me. It was a number 4 story. Dark energy find helps constrain its properties. The past year gave us another confirmation of dark energy's existence. Can you talk about what it is and what we found last year that confirmed that it exists?
So one of the big reasons why this story is so important is it was a second way of finding or proving dark energy's existence, or I guess not entirely proving, but determining that dark energy very likely exists. And it's a completely independent method from the one that astronomers used in 1998 when they initially discovered that some mysterious force is making our galaxy or our universe expand in an accelerating fashion, something speeding up the acceleration or the expansion of our universe. Astronomers in 1998 had used exploding stars and found that found that more distant ones are actually more distant and fainter than they had expected, which meant that they must be farther away than initially expected, which meant that the universe was expanding at an accelerating pace. So the finding this time around was astronomers used the Chandra X-ray Observatory to study galaxy clusters, conglomerations of galaxies, and found that around 5 billion years ago, these clusters seemed to kind of not stall out, but they weren't forming as quickly, mm-hmm. and they weren't forming as large. So something was opposing the force of gravity roughly at that time. And when you look at, they compared galaxy clusters from the present universe, which is considered within about 500 million to 1 billion years, light years away. And they compared galaxy clusters from farther out, maybe 6 billion light years away, and saw that present time, these galaxy clusters are less of them, and they're not as big. So something is, like I said, opposing the force of gravity, and that something is dark energy. So the big story here is that it was a completely independent confirmation of something is causing, you know, something is opposing gravity and making our universe accelerate. And it's not so much the finding of dark energy, because we did that in 1998, but it's the fact that, like I said, a completely independent finding or method, and that way you can combine this method with the other method, and you can help narrow down properties of dark energy.
Well, that's something. I mean, that's the stuff that kind of blows your mind, doesn't it? It's,
yes.
Whoa, wait a second. What is this? It's hard to put it all into words. And when you're talking about that kind of time, too. Whew.
Oh, yes. I know. It's crazy that they have the ability to really study what the universe was like at half its present age and even farther back in time than that.
Isn't that something? What did we learn? There was something new, I can't remember this, about the Milky Way in 2009. What did we learn about the Milky Way?
Milky Way.
There was I think it's on your list, the violent center,
yes.
The baby stars in the center or something?
Astronomers have been, they've seen younger stars in the vicinity of our galactic center, which is very odd because of there's a supermassive black hole at our galaxy center. And the environment around that is expected to be, well, it's very violent. You're going to have a lot of winds, a lot of turbulence, chaotic environment. So how could stars form in that type of environment? In order to form, stars need to have a more relaxed area where the gas can condense in order for the star to eventually light up. And so when you have a very turbulent area, in theory, should not allow any gas to condense, and you know it would push the gas around. But two groups in 2009 announced discoveries of very young stars, protostars, that have not quite—they're not as old. You know, they're within a few million years old, 1 or 2 million years old. And these stars have been found very close to the galactic center, which means, okay, yes, they exist, but then one of the groups even found some of these stars embedded in larger amounts of gas, which is showing that, yeah, they can form there, just don't fully know how or why, but if these baby stars are not alone, but they're actually embedded in larger clumps of gas, they must be able to form. So that was pretty much the big news regarding that, that we're getting more evidence for these things that can form in such a chaotic atmosphere.
And only fitting that there be a 2009 Milky Way story, because your eighth biggest story was about Galileo, that last year was the International Year of Astronomy. 400 years earlier in 1609, he pointed his spyglass toward the heavens and saw the Milky Way band in a way never before viewed.
Yep, before that, it was, you know, this thick band across the sky, and he pointed his spyglass up, an early telescope, and realized that that band is actually composed of a bunch of individual dots, stars. The 2009 was the International Year of Astronomy, and there were hundreds of events occurring year-round, some very big ones which involved 160 different sites. It was just a huge year and huge participation by astronomers and observatories and the public to look up and explore, you know, the night sky and even the daytime sky by observing the sun. Galileo, you know, did so much for our advancement of the science of astronomy, in addition to realizing that the Milky Way is actually composed of stars, but also he studied Jupiter's four moons and realized that, you know, moons can circulate or encircle other objects, so we're not the center of the universe. If there are moons circling Jupiter, that means that, you know, something else can be an object, you know, a central object, which means that maybe the sun is actually a central object in our solar system. He looked at the moon and realized that it's not perfect as was expected. It actually had craters and it had, it was dimpled and just didn't look like a perfect sphere, which is what they thought at the time. So Galileo did a lot, and it's only gotten better since then. I mean, the technology has certainly improved, and the findings have, you know, multiplied by millions.
It is remarkable to think of what he was trying to counteract and how primitively we thought of the sky just 400 years ago. And look where we are now.
Oh, I know. And we're finding out, you know, not just about our solar system and our Milky Way, but we're finding out about the universe. And as you said, some crazy theories that are just very difficult to wrap your head around. But, yeah, we're able to use mathematics and computers and observatories and combine all that information to come up with theories of how our universe began and how it evolved.
Right. We're going to welcome more phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Liz Cruzy, Associate Editor of Astronomy Magazine, is our guest, and we're talking about astronomy's cover story for February, which is the top 10 stories of 2009. We've covered most of them. There are others. What would you include? And, you know, the broader question here is the amount of money and effort that we spend in space exploration. What do you, when you think about what you've learned from Hubble, have you ever gone to the website to look at the pictures? When you think about spending money, this is a perennial question on space exploration. Do we need to go further here? Have we learned some extraordinary things about how we were created and what's beyond us? And is it worth almost every dime we can muster up to figure all that out? Or are there limits? So join our conversation if you'd like. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Liz Cruzy is our guest this hour. She is Associate Editor of Astronomy Magazine, the 10 Big Stories of the Skies in 2009, the 400th anniversary of astronomy, is our topic this hour. And here's our number again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Story number 10 on the list, on April 23rd, the Swift X-ray satellite witnessed a record-breaking gamma ray burst, a blast that signals the explosive death of a massive star. The picture that accompanies this is just quite extraordinary. And Swift saw 10 seconds of gamma rays. Can you explain to me, so that I can understand it, Liz, what a gamma ray is and why this was a significant story?
Gamma rays are the highest energy radiation that exists. We have the electromagnetic spectrum, and we have the visible light area of that, which is a very small region, roughly halfway in between, and that's what we can see. When you go more energetic than visible light is ultraviolet light. More energetic than that are X-rays. More energetic than that are gamma rays. Very high energy. And a gamma ray burst is, they don't entirely know the physics of these objects, but a very massive star, as it dies, goes through phase, and then spits out these jets of high-energy radiation. And in those jets, you have gamma rays, hence the name gamma ray burst. You also have other radiation that follows. And so the Swift satellite is pretty much, as soon as it detects a burst of gamma rays, it can move and observe the location of that object. And it's charted hundreds of gamma ray bursts in our skies.
And this was found by this Swift X-ray satellite. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, the Swift X-ray satellite, like I mentioned, it's one of its big purposes is to detect gamma ray bursts. The Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which launched in June of 2008, also can detect gamma ray bursts. And so when it detects them, what the Swift does is it'll move, observe it, pinpoint the location, and then send the location to telescopes, observatories all over the country, all over the world, and then you can get telescopes on the ground, which can then observe the visible light spectrum coming from that object. Then you have Fermi, which is a satellite, which can observe the gamma rays. Gamma rays and X-rays cannot penetrate through our atmosphere, so in order to observe them, we need satellites orbiting our world. So we can piece together the full radiation spectrum, again, kind of the wavelengths coming from this object, by using various ground-based telescopes and various satellites to get, you know, what the spectrum actually says is its distance, the object's distance, and the material in the galaxy surrounding that object, because this is a star that died, so it's got to be in a galaxy, right?
Right.
And when those jets of radiation come spewing toward us, it's going to almost light up the galaxy material between that object and us. So we can piece together, well, by looking at that spectrum that's coming toward us, we can figure out, well, astronomers can figure out the distance of the object and some of the chemical makeup.
Hmm. Let's go to more callers. Betty from Waukesha is next. Hi, Betty.
Yes, I think this is marvelous information and just fascinating. And I have more or less followed it through the years, just casually. But I do think that the overwhelming issue of today is climate change. And I do think that NASA does spend a lot of funds that I think could be dedicated, and some of this information would be very helpful in combating climate change. But I think any large expenditure should be reserved for what we can do for climate change in any way that this wonderful project can serve that would be the best way to use the funding. I don't know. It's a very convoluted way to say it. But
no, I understand what you're saying. And I'm wondering if any of what we learned in 2009 gives us a better understanding of climate change.
Yeah. I know a number of NASA. NASA has other satellites that are observing not the stars, but are looking at Earth and photographing things such as Antarctica. And so you're looking at ice loss. Other satellites are observing temperature differences throughout, well, on Earth. And so you can compare that to temperature maps from years ago and notice any increase in temperature, decrease in temperature. So they do put quite a bit of money toward the science of climate change. Hubble itself can't observe our Earth just given its it has to do with its optics. So if you look at, you know, an image of Mars compared to an image of, or an image of Uranus compared to an image of a distant galaxy, the distant galaxy is going to be a lot more detailed than that of Uranus, and it's because it's so much closer to the planet that it cannot get as much detail on its cameras. And so it would not be able to actually observe anything on Earth, so we couldn't use Hubble for that. But like I said, NASA does have a number of satellites that are looking at Earth's environment and climate change.
And when you think of your years of, as you said, casually observing all of this, Betty, what's on your number one or number two or both on your top 10 list of what you thought was really spectacular during your lifetime?
Well, not especially the dishes, but the beauty of space itself. The marvel, and I understand there's a new book of photographs that are simply, and that to me is so marvelous, in the fact of antimatter and
dark energy. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, are just fascinating concepts. And, of course, so many things that we assumed when I was a girl, I'm very old, we're now finding out are not working as we thought. And so I think it's wonderful. But most overwhelming for me is the very extreme beauty of outer space.
It is amazing, isn't it? You look at these pictures in the magazine and you go, whoa, it's just something.
Oh, yeah, the detail that Hubble can pick up of a distant nebula or star-forming region, it's just, it's gorgeous.
Yes, and I did feel that Hubble Space, there was a movement to destroy it for a while, wasn't there?
Yes, there was.
Or stop it from functioning and just leave it hanging there?
Well,
wasn't there?
If the funding, if those parts had died, there's nothing that you can really do. It's just kind of up there. They don't have any plans to actually bring Hubble back to Earth safely. So once it does die, it will spiral into the ocean, which is kind of a sad ending for such a wonderful piece of equipment. But just to bring it back to Earth to go into any sort of, Smithsonian museum is just so expensive. So,
and the poor ocean seems to be able to, we seem to want it to take all of our debris. I think that's a shame, too. So.
Thank you, Betty, so much for your call.
Okay.
Let's go to John from Northern Wisconsin. Hi, John.
Yes, ma'am. I, too, love the beautiful pictures, especially in National Geographic, with great color prints. I even bought these big books of the photographs to give to my kids. But then I caught an article in Popular Science magazine that the constellations out there are just gray smudges. There is no color. All of that has been added by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory because the director of the Hubble Project says we have to have something pretty to sell. And all these coloring book fireworks displays are, in fact, all added and all man-made. I want Hubble and the people to publish some pictures of the constellations as they are. Enough of this coloring book nonsense, reds, greens, blues. No. You look out there and remember the gold shield on the astronauts' helmets. You're looking at atomic explosions, and it's a grayish white. All the stars, all the constellations are smudges, and it's digitalized and colorized to make them look sexy, to keep the public interested. So it's a bit of a fraud, really, and I was shocked, and I'm sorry I bought the books. I mean, they're pretty books, but my grandchildren can color coloring books and be just as true and just as correct. I just don't like dishonesty.
Well, what NASA's actually doing is they're taking different filters. So they may be taking something in infrared, which we can't see, something in visible. And, if you're going to look at one of these objects, if you look at the Orion Nebula with your own eyes, it has a very slight grayish-green color. But what they're doing is they're taking different wavelengths that we can't see, and assigning maybe invisible light, we're going to assign it as green. And then in infrared, we'll assign it as red. In ultraviolet, we'll assign it as blue. And then they combine the data from those three, and it's like if you could see from infrared through ultraviolet, maybe that's what you'd see. So they are taking real data. It's just, it is, I'm not going to say it's coloring book, but it is slightly, it's something that we can't see with our human eyes. But other, telescopes that can see from that wavelength, this huge range of wavelengths could see something much more colorful.
Hmm.
So they are stacking images, because if you look at any of these objects just with your eyes, you're not going to see anywhere near that detail. We just, our eyes can't contain it. And the stars do, some stars have a slight blue tinge, some stars have a slight red tinge, and that has to do with the temperature of the star itself. Cooler stars will radiate in more of a reddish color, and hot, really hot stars will radiate in a bluer color. And again, our eyes are not as sensitive to those colors as a camera, which can just take a picture for hours, and therefore it's gathering all this light, which when it all adds together is going to be a more vibrant color than what we can see before we blink.
Thank you so much, John, for the call. We have less than a minute, but let's try to get to Carl from Madison. Hi, Carl.
Hi, I'm fantastic, and so are you, Kathleen and Liz. Liz, could you, if you know, give me some parameters about the physical parameters about the Hubble telescope. I mean, what's its size, its weight, and the main unit, and with all of its paraphernalia deployed, like, you know, solar arrays and whatnot?
The mirror itself, it's 2.4 meters. It's 2.4 feet. In diameter, and the actual telescope, people say it's about the size of a small bus, if that helps. I'm not sure about the weight itself, but it's a very small bus, maybe a large van size.
Okay, well, that's better than... Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. And thank you, Liz, so much for being with us this hour. Happy New Year.
You too.
Thanks. Liz Cruzy is Associate Editor of Astronomy Magazine, our guest this hour. Their cover story for February, top 10 stories from Astronomy Magazine on what we learned from the skies during the year 2009. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for all on-air production of this show today from downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. And we'll be with you again tomorrow, same time from 9 to 11, to talk about interesting topics, which we always do. News ahead and many more hours of great conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.